for P97. Welcome to week 8. And this week we are extremely fortunate to have two guest lecturers that I think you're really, really, really going to enjoy. Our first guest is Jack Han, and if you have not heard of Jack before, he's an extremely bright hockey mind, formerly the assistant coach of the Toronto Marlies, player development scouting and analytics assistant for the Toronto Maple Leafs, video coach and analytics coordinator for the McGill University women's hockey team. He also wrote for the Montreal Canadiens official website, assistant coach for College Jean de Brébeuf in Montreal. He is exactly who you want to be listening to if you're interested in the new ideas that are percolating through the hockey industry right now. He also writes the Hockey Tactics newsletter, which is jhanhky.substack.com. I've provided a link to it on the course reading section of your Brightspace. This is going to be beginning our week on hockey analytics, and it's something that I think you may be slightly familiar with. Maybe this is something you're extremely passionate about. Maybe you care a great deal about this type of work. Maybe you don't. That's okay. This is definitely something that if we were teaching this course 20 years ago, would certainly not have been a week. I mean, this is something that's emerged in the last decade or so as a full-fledged part of the industry, and even if it's not something that directly relates to your field, understanding the ways in which you can evaluate player performance and team success in this fashion is extremely important. I think truly one of the most beneficial guest lecturers we're going to have just in terms of career advice is Jack. Jack gives some very frank advice regarding how you should negotiate, how you should think of these positions that directly addresses the stage of career that you are in right now as a fourth year student here at Brock. He speaks directly to people he's worked with at Brock. And I think he's an extremely valuable voice that I would love. I was just so pleased with some of the things that he was able to share. So again, make sure you're writing things down when you're listening to Jack, because you're going to have to be including them on your audio response a little bit later on. I also wanted to again, thank you for those of you who continue to do that as a practice, that you'll be rewarded for it in the end when you are evaluated on the audio responses. I really appreciate hearing it. I go back and I listen and I think, oh, they are listening. They are absolutely following along, and it's a great feeling. So when you're listening to Jack, note down anything you think is interesting, write down the time, make it easier on yourself when you are submitting your audio responses. Our second guest lecturer is going to be Dom Lucchesin from The Athletic, and Dom's fantastic in his own right and is filled with lots of great advice as well. But let's first dive into this notion of hockey analytics and what is it, and why are we spending any degree of time on it at all? I think it's extremely important that we contextualize this discussion as that of a change in ideas that occurred in professional sports basically in the beginning of the 21st century. You're probably familiar with Moneyball. You're probably familiar with that story. Perhaps you've seen the movie, perhaps you have not. But I would caution you not to imagine the sort of world of analytics as being simply the story of data-driven search for market inefficiencies in baseball and then other sports seemingly trying to capture their version of that. I think that too often that gets characterized as analytics, and this is something that is very near and dear to me, this notion of what is analytics. And just imagine to yourself, this could be a question that you have to answer your own very soon. If I asked you, what is an analytic? What is an analytic for determining the success of a business or a professional sports franchise or a movie or anything really that requires measurements of success? You're going to get wildly different definitions of this word. And in the business community, and perhaps even in other courses in this university, you have used other definitions of the word analytics. And one of the things that I think in contemporary discourse, in sports discourse certainly, we can get pretty hung up on this notion of what analytics is or is not. So for instance, if you're a soccer fan right now, and if you follow soccer at all, if you don't, that's okay. Well, stay with me for a second here. And if you are thinking about the most simplistic ways of measuring shots during a game, if you hit a pause menu on a FIFA game, if you've known this from when you were a kid, there are two measurements of shots, one being shots and one being shots on target. It's extremely basic things. Well, one of the early quote-unquote analytics that were introduced to hockey was Corsi, pioneered by a man named Jim Corsi, a former goaltending coach for the Buffalo Sabres. And he starts measuring not just the shots that reach the goalies, but the ones that miss the net as well. And this measurement, this metric, this statistic becomes referred to as Corsi. It's one of the earliest statistics in your readings. You actually hear about one of these stats in its sort of infancy. Now, In soccer, is that considered some sort of high-minded analytic? No, this is a basic rudimentary statistic. And so many of the stats you hear about when you're recording hockey statistics and evaluating of these quote-unquote fancy stats, some of them can seem impenetrable. And in some sports, they are extremely complex. Look, baseball has had a lot longer to mature in this space, and some of the measurements are legitimately complex and extremely difficult to sort of break down into their component parts. But that's not necessarily the case in hockey quite yet. And some of the statistics are quite easy to understand, but they sit behind this veil of impenetrability because they are labeled with the A word, analytics, this thing that seems to be a castigation of traditional forms of understanding the way we play hockey. This is a foolish and I think misguided way of imagining that hockey teams operate today in this industry. This isn't about simply coming up with ways to sort of devalue traditional forms of evaluation. This is a way of trying to quantify success in different ways and failure in different ways as well. And I think that that's a very important part of the way we look at things. And putting yourself in one camp or another is, I think, a foolish strategy for many of you who are entering into the industry itself. In fact, I've taught this course many times. I've had an exercise which there are sort of two camps, one in favor of disbanding an analytics department and one in favor of an expansion of the analytics department. You have to spend based on a salary cap. And every single year that I do this course, I come in expecting the younger generation of students to, of course, support an expansion of the analytics department. And I'm yet to come across a majority decision in that way yet. I'm noticing a lot of resistance that occurs towards the notion of whatever analytics is in the minds of students, because it's based in this dichotomous relationship between traditional and sort of analytically minded ways of viewing hockey. So don't think in these terms of in this dichotomous way. It's not a good idea, and it doesn't do either side of the debate any service. So when Jack is talking about the ways in which he found a career for himself, it's not so much about the fact that he's a super genius, which of course he is extremely intelligent and extremely hardworking. But it's his ability to generate a positive outcomes for himself based on his own unique skill set. That is something I found extremely unique about Jack. In your readings, in the article for this week, it sort of helps explain the development of these statistics and how they've been started to be used in their various sports. But again, if you have no familiarity with this as a subject matter, go read up on it, go and have a look around, see if you can sort of parse some of those statistics. I give you an idea of what Corsi is, which is basically, again, a measurement of shots directed at the net. But another gentleman, a blogger and a Calgary Flames fan at this point, was a man named Matt Fenwick, and I believe he's a math teacher in a secondary school in Alberta. And his thought was, well, hey, look, blocking shots, that's actually a skill. We should probably reward players for that skill. So Fenwick became a measurement of you measure the shots towards the net minus blocked shots, because then you could demonstrate the effectiveness of blocking shots. And in that statistic, for instance, you can see a marriage between the old and new ways of thinking. It's a quantification of a skill that is traditionally seen as part of the old way of knowing the game, whatever that means. So I encourage you, have an open mind. If you're totally sold on this notion of analytics, if you're like, yes, I'm a believer, you don't have to convince me, I totally love this stuff, then focus on what Jack is telling you from a career angle, how he sort of plotted a career for himself and demonstrated his worth. And lastly, before I pass things off to our guest lecturer, I want to note that he is extremely interested in questions. So if you have any questions, pass them along to me, because he wants to use them in his weekly newsletters that he passes out on his Substack, the Hockey Tactics newsletter. So if you have a question for Jack, anything involving the modern game, not about his life necessarily, but though you can, or about your favorite team even, pass them along to me. I'll get them to Jack and he'll put them in his newsletter. Make sure you're noting down any important points. And with no further ado, I will pass things off to Jack Han and our discussion of hockey analytics and making a career in this space. We are so fortunate to be joined by Jack Han. Jack, thank you so much for joining 4P97 here at Brock University.
Well, I'm happy to be here, Taylor. You know, as we mentioned before we started recording, I've actually worked with a couple of Brock alums who's graduated from this program, Kyle Dubas being the more famous one. But it's, you know, it's obviously a very exciting field to be in. It's also a very competitive field. I'm hoping to bring a slightly different perspective and actually, you know, give the students a little bit of, you know, tough love or good information in terms of how to prepare for a career in this field, and maybe, you know, a few tips on how to make the most of whatever opportunity you get.
Jack, what a perfect introduction. That's fantastic. Jack, let's start at the beginning. What were your earliest experiences with the game of hockey?
So, just to kind of give you like a 30-second recap of who I am, I got my start working hockey actually with the Montreal Canadiens on the digital content side. So I was a beat writer for the team website. I also managed a team's social media account in the 2013-14 season. After actually during the course of that season, as someone who's grown up with the game in Montreal, someone who's played growing up, I realized that it seems like there is room in the game for someone like me who's maybe more analytically minded. And the following season, I decided to kind of, well, first of all, my contract wasn't renewed, which is a reality of the business. When that happened, I decided that I wanted to keep working in hockey, but more on the coaching and hockey ops side. So for the next 3 seasons, I became a video coach slash analytics coordinator for the McGill University women's team. And after those 3 years, I became, as far as I know, the first person to go from U Sports women's hockey straight to the NHL when Kyle Dubas approached me for a job as a player development analyst with the Toronto Maple Leafs. After spending 3 seasons with the Leafs in player development, hockey ops, and then as an assistant coach with the Marlies, I left the organization during the pandemic, which generally is a bad time to leave a job. But since then, I've been working as a consultant for a variety of players and teams. And also, I've started writing again, whether it's on Twitter or on my personal blog or newsletter. And now I make a full-time living creating content online, ebooks related to hockey tactics and specifically NHL tactics. And also consulting for teams such as the Connecticut Whale and also the ZSC Lions in the Swiss League. So, all that said, I've been in the game now at the pro level for about 10 years. It's actually quite an unlikely story because I was born in China and we moved to Montreal when I was 6 years old. My parents didn't play the game. They didn't know the first thing about hockey. And to now finally to answer your question, my first contact with hockey was when we first moved to Montreal around 96, 97. The big rivalry at the time were the Detroit Red Wings and the Colorado Avalanche. And so my first exposure to hockey was watching them beat the crap out of each other on TV, like with the Claude Lemieux, Chris Draper saga. So that was my first exposure to hockey, and then a lot of my friends played growing up, so I kind of followed them into it. I didn't play at a super high level. I wouldn't say that I was really extremely passionate about the game when I first started playing. In fact, I was the worst player on my team, the first couple of years of organized hockey I played, and then I stopped for a few years, and then when I started back up again when I was 11, 12, 13, that's when they started being kind of content online about how to play hockey better, how to, off ice drills that you can do. I remember also asking my parents to buy me, books and CDs and DVDs about stick handling. And so basically I brought like a very kind of academic perspective to playing hockey because basically nobody I grew up with really took the time to show me how because they didn't know how. So I kind of had to learn all by myself, whether it's via books or videos or kind of in a very academic setting. And I think that kind of molded my whole perspective on hockey because, I didn't play major junior or pro, but, I think I did okay with the resources I had. And I just think that with all the information available now, there's a way for you to deepen your understanding of our sport academically. And through that, I think you can kind of expand your potential. And I think it's a really great way to kind of live your passion for the sport.
Jack, you've answered so many of my questions right there. That's an amazing journey. I love your description there of
your academic interest in learning the game itself when you were a player? Because you seem to have also translated that also into your career as well. There's so many stops along the way that I want to take some time and allow you to elaborate on. Let's start with McGill. When you arrived with McGill and with the women's team as a video and analyst and analytics coordinator, what was your sort of initial impression? What was the learning curve like when you started with McGill?
It's a very important, I think, lesson when you're looking to start out. So if you're looking to kind of bridge that gap between, you know, studying sport management versus getting your first, whether it's internship, part-time job or full-time job, you got to realize that it's very difficult to kind of step right into the top level of the game. But on the flip side, it's also quite easy to get a foothold, you know, in one of the lower levels, because the farther down you go in hockey, the more there's going to be people who are actively looking for help from people just like, you know, you or me, or a fourth year university student with an interest in pursuing this career. So what happened at McGill was, so I got let go from my job with the Canadians, and then I kind of had a couple of months to think about what I wanted to do over the summer. And one of the things that I thought of was, so I did my undergrad at McGill, and a few of my classmates actually played on the women's hockey team. And I knew of the program. You know, they had a very strong women's hockey program back then. They had several Olympians come through that program. Their head coach, Peter Smith, went to the Olympics twice, I believe, was the assistant for Team Canada, won 2 gold medals with the team. So I knew that, you know, this side of the Montreal Canadiens, one of the highest level coaches and one of the highest level programs in terms of hockey on the island of Montreal was actually the McGill women's program. So I figured, let me reach out to see if they'd be interested to have somebody, you know, whether it's on the analytics side or the video side or anything else really. And as it turned out, the Martlets' former video coach had moved on, to pursue another line of work. And then Peter was actively looking for a video coach, and he was actually having a lot of trouble finding the right person. So it was kind of, you know, serendipity, because we found each other at the right moment, at the perfect moment, in fact. But it just goes to show that, you know, this is a very very big program with a big reputation, a big in terms of a lot of success, but they still had trouble recruiting the right people. So the lesson that taught me was, you know, if you're somebody looking to start out in hockey, you know, you might write to 25 or 32 NHL teams and not hear back, but, you know, try AHL teams or ECHL teams, or maybe a major junior team, or even a junior B team, or, you know, U18 team somewhere. There's somebody out there who needs your help if you're willing to put in the time and effort. So that's the first thing.
Great lesson here, especially because, again, they are all of us in this room are at a university right now with a women's program, with a men's program. And certainly there are students in this class, students that have gone through this class that have worked with junior B, junior C teams. But I mean, we often talk about this. U Sports hockey in general is a great starting place. Can you speak to your experience working in U Sports? How did you find your experience with the quality of play? What were your level of resources like? How would you describe your time during U Sports?
So the first thing, which, you know, it was a minus but turned to a big plus, was the first thing that Peter asked me to do was, if I wanted to work in analytics for a team, I also had to take over as the video coach, because that was the role that, you know, was the most, that was a more important frame. And what ended up happening was, after learning, you know, how to operate the video system and how to, you know, operate the camera and all that, I actually found that it really sped up my work as an analyst, because I was able to track events directly off of the video software. So we used a software called Stiva, which is an older software that I think a lot of U Sports teams still use. But basically I was able to reprogram the software where, you know, every key that I hit logged, whether it's shot attempt, whether it's exit or entries. And then I was able to export all of these events into a CSV file. And then I was able to do a lot of manipulation in terms of figuring out, you know, which lines or which D pairs drove results for a team and so on and so forth. So That was a really great coincidence, because if you go, let's say, to the NHL or the AHL level, the video and the analytics side of hockey ops, they're pretty distinct. Like they'd be these roles would be filled by different people. And so I found it was actually really great to kind of be that two-on-one person to start with, because it gave me a really great insight into how the workflow was like. And that really helped me later on as well, because basically if you want to, the best way to get a job in hockey ops these days is either you have, some sort of traditional playing background or, knowledge of scouting, or you're really good with video, or you're really good with stats. It's one of those three and probably a mix of the three.
Great description there again of that journey and the wide level of experience you get working at with the U Sports team. Now you mentioned that's quite a jump from McGill straight to the highest echelons. Can you speak about that? Can you speak to us about that jump you made? What were your initial impressions when you made the jump to pro hockey, and what were some of the lessons you learned in those initial moments?
So I forgot to mention, but one of the big upsides of working in U Sports is there's not that many games. So we had, including exhibition and tournament games, we had about 40 games a season, and there's not a lot of travel. Like for McGill, we play in RSCQ, and it's basically Montreal, and we have three teams in Montreal and then two teams in the Ottawa area. So what that does is that I was able to hold down a full-time job and also put in a good 20, 25 hours a week at McGill. Whereas if you look at whether it's an AHL schedule or an NHL schedule, we're talking about 70, 80 games a season. You're basically, if you're working in a league that has 80 games, it better be a full-time job, because you're not going to have time for anything else. Whereas if we're talking about maybe university hockey, or perhaps, junior B, or perhaps European hockey, a lot of these leagues have fewer games. So if you're looking to start out, if you're not sure that it's going to be a full-time career for you, and you have, a full-time career that you're already kind of, you're well on your way, then start out with in a league with fewer games. The PHF also is a league like that, where we have about 20, 25 games a season. So, one of my good friends who does a lot of public hockey work now and now works for the Montreal Force of the PHF, a guy by the name of Nick Nahabedian, he's doing his CPA right now. And I think he's about to get his title, but he's able to juggle all of those things because, again, he works for a team that plays in a league with only 25 regular season games.
So when you make the jump to the pros, that's one of the first learning curves, I'm sure, as you're dealing with just a staggering amount of games right away. And what was your initial sort of role? What were your initial impressions when you make that first jump? I mean, certainly there's a lot more materials, a lot more data. I can't fathom how much more data you're dealing with when you get to the pro game. But what were some of the lessons you learned quickly about making that jump?
So again, I think that the difference is just the sheer number of games in terms of the workload. There is certainly you have more to do per day, but also there are more game days. So that's going to make a very big difference in terms of, if anybody listening to this is lucky enough to have, to get a break and to be offered an NHL job. There's a few kind of practical things that I would suggest. First of all, make sure that the financials make sense for you. If you have to move halfway across the country to get this job, ask for enough money. Make sure that you ask for a multi-year contract, because if you don't and you're on a one-year contract and you have to move and something happens where maybe the GM gets fired, the coach gets fired, there's new ownership, you want to be protected, because most of these jobs are contractual. They're not full-time permanent positions. So, if let's say you have a strong programming background and a strong hockey background, which is the case for somebody that I spoke with recently who asked me kind of those same questions, and you're being recruited to work in an analytics position for an NHL team halfway around the country, ask for a three-year contract and they'll probably end up giving you two. Do not settle for a 1 year contract. And you know, you're probably going to leave money on the table to work for a pro hockey team as opposed to doing the same thing for, you know, a company in another industry. But at least don't shortcharge yourself in terms of term, right? Ask for a multi-year contract. So, the first year I worked in Toronto, I kind of didn't follow my own advice. Kyle offered me 1 year at an amount that I thought was really fair. And the other thing that really tipped the balance for me was that in the first year, he didn't ask me to move. So I was able to actually still work from Montreal, where I lived at the time and where I live right now. And then a couple of times a month, the Maple Leafs actually, you know, bought me a plane ticket, got me down to Toronto, and then I was able to meet face to face with a lot of my colleagues. But most of the work was done remotely on my computer, which is a situation that, again, I think it's a good bargaining chip because it really reduces your level of risk in terms of having to kind of uproot yourself.
That's fantastic advice, and that's advice that I think, you know, a lot of these students are in need of, you know, what to even do if you do get this, and not to just get completely starstruck by the idea of working for a team and willing to uproot your life and do a whole bunch of other things for what can be a very, very, very short term situation. So what were the biggest sort of misconceptions that you think exist, or what are the biggest misconceptions that exist about the work that you did, whether it was on the McGill side or the pro side, about the kind of work you do, and also in as it relates to the wider hockey public?
So the one thing that I believe very strongly in is that even if you're working in a data-oriented position, your job is not about data, it's about time. In fact, your job is to be a help in someone else's time management. So I'll give you an example. When I was at McGill, I did most of Peter's pre-scouts. So the fact that I you know, download two games of our next opponent. I go through them, I clip them, I set up the playlist, and then I give him a preliminary playlist to go through and to then like filter down. That saves him about 5 hours, if not more. So that's the value, really. It's, you know, if you're someone making 50,000 working an entry level NHL job, you're probably saving, I don't know, $250,000 upstream throughout a season just because you're doing stuff that other people could do, but you know, they're better off not doing. So that's your value. So you should be able to easily provide a 5 or 10 time, you know, a d return on it on investment on your salary, essentially. So really that's what you aim for. And you know, I had an experience recently where we're in the process of buying a house, and we worked with a very good real estate agent. And you know, so her job not only is to help us save time, but also manage our anxiety. And it sounds kind of silly for me to say this, but hockey is the same as anything else in life. You know, people are anxious, and especially in a in an industry where it's so competitive and it's so everything is so transparent, right? Like you know that, you know, on any in any given season, like half the team in the league, they're in the world of hurt because they're just scraping to make the playoffs, or they're just scraping to kind of, you know, put points on the board. And you know, you can be very good at your job, and you can do a great deal. But if you're someone who's actively increasing the anxiety level of people around you, you're not going to be there for very long. And the opposite is true as well. Like, you know, I think there's a case to be made that pro sports is very, you know, there's a lot of nepotism in pro sports. And certainly I think it's quite easy for people in authority positions to give jobs to their friends or to their relatives or their kids. But at the same time, you know, I think there's a rationale for that because your level of anxiety is lowered when you hire people that you already know. So, the two takeaways for, you know, folks who are in their fourth year university, first of all, is the goal of networking and to talk to people and to, you know, create relationships is that you're basically coming in warm with people and you're reducing their anxiety level. And then once you get the job again, to be consistent, to show up, to, you know, do your job properly, to do things with minimal supervision, these are all things that are going to help lower the anxiety level of your immediate superiors, which are in turn going to improve your financial outlook and your career success.
Jack, that's great. That's just fantastic advice. I mean, that's great advice no matter what area of sport you're looking to get into, but certainly the hockey industry is no exception. There's something about your work that really fascinates me, and that's your outreach to the public and your ability to distill very complex things to the public very quickly. It's something that you have done extremely well throughout your time, throughout your extremely unique career so far. Can you tell us about that decision and where you just developed that skill set and where you developed that interest in sort of communicating tactics to the public?
I think I've had that interest for a while, and even, you know, going back to my first NHL job with Montreal in 2013-14, like I felt this urge to kind of be a little bit more in depth. You know, I kind of slowly start bringing up concepts such as Corsi or such as, you know, lineup adjustment, stuff like that. And, you know, I honestly got some pushback from my editor about that, but I think it just kind of showed that I had an interest for it and I had a knack for it. And now because I'm my own boss, I'm able to really fully exploit that. But going back, like my big talent in life is not playing hockey, it's writing. So to give you an idea, when I was 5 years old, I was reading at a fifth grade level. And that's because I spent a lot of time with my grandparents, and they were both teachers, and they didn't have any toys at their house. They only had books. So I would read, basically, I was like a toddler reading, you know, books for elementary school kids. So I was always pretty advanced for my age, and it's no different than a lot of players who ended up playing the NHL. You know, they were always advanced. More advanced on the ice. So I was always more advanced, you know, in a schoolroom setting. So when it came time for me to, you know, leave Toronto and then reorient myself in a very unfavorable, you know, pandemic environment, I thought my biggest competitive advantage is I don't have to get on the ice to help people understand hockey or help people improve their understanding of how to play. I could just write about it, or I can, you know, make videos about it, or I can, you know, write eBooks about it. And so basically it all came together because it was a competitive advantage for me to work in this way. If any other NHL coach decided that, you know, all of a sudden they're going to start writing a newsletter or start writing eBooks or tweeting, they're not going to do it as well as I do, even though they know more about hockey and they have more experience than I do. Right. They're just not, because I've been working on this skill set for, you know, I'm 33 now. I've been working on this skill set for 28 years at least. Whereas they're gonna have to start from zero. So it's just simple economics, right? It's just the division of labor, or it's, you know, comparative advantage, and I'm just making full use of it.
And you really do. I mean, again, I encourage everyone listening to this to sign up to your newsletter, to sign up to your Substack. I mean, it is fantastic. I mean, and again, since the earliest days of me following you on Twitter, I mean, you have communicated such complex things that take coaches on whiteboards, banging on the glass, you know, about forechecks and things like that, that take decades for players and students of the game to learn. You explain it in 15 minutes. It makes so much sense. And I will only have one more question for you, Jack. And again, I really, really, really appreciate your time here today. How do you see the relationship between data and hockey evolving over the next 5 years?
Well, that's a good question. I mean, it's a question I think about on a regular basis. The most accurate answer that I could give you is I don't know. But the way that I'm working now is I would say I'm tracking less stats, and I'm, you know, using maybe less stats in my process than I used to. And again, this is because my comparative advantage is elsewhere. So there are lots of people online who have a lot of time and a lot of, you know, determination, a lot of put in a lot of effort to manually track stats. And, you know, it's no longer an area of comparative advantage for me to do that. If I ever, you know, need very specific help in that area, I'm now better off hiring somebody, right? And or paying for a service such as whether it's InStats or SportLogic to have those things provided to me. So basically, the upshot is the game of hockey itself is it's not going to change all that much in 5 years. You know, if we hop into a time machine and we look at what hockey looks like in 5 years, we're going to see some differences. But for the most part, it's going to be the same game. There's going to be one puck on the ice. There's going to be two goals, probably still the same dimension. The rink is probably going to still be the same dimension. The players will look more or less the same. The tactics might look a little bit different, but they're still going to be recognizably similar to today's. So what I'm saying is that the relationship between data and hockey, the biggest change is going to be how it's presented and how it's communicated. It's not necessarily going to be the nature of the sport that's going to change, right?
Jack, thank you so much for your time here. On behalf of everyone here at 4P97, I really want to thank you for speaking to all of you digitally. And we wish you well. Again, the Hockey Tactics newsletter on Substack. Is there anywhere else you'd like my students to know about in terms of finding your work?
Well, I mean, look, feel free to share my email with them if ever any of them have a question about whether it's general career advice or specific career advice. Feel free to send me an email. I reserve the right to use the answer I give on my future newsletter, because that's probably going to, if one person has that question, then it's probably going to help one-on-one people. But yeah, so if you'd like to get in touch, if you have a question, then by all means, reach out.
Thanks so much, Jack.